Hello. The late Roman Republic covers an approximately 100-year period, extending from 133 BC to 31 BC. And it's in this time that the various tensions and resentments that had been developing all throughout the Roman Republic ultimately reach a crisis point. And it will result in the dissolution of the Roman Republic. We begin with two brothers, who were actually the grandsons of Scipio Africanus. And so these are guys that come from the most elite and privileged class in Roman society. But despite that aristocratic lineage, the elder brother of these two, named Tiberius Gracchus, looked around and became worried about these tensions that were building in Roman society. And he determined to do something about it. Accordingly, in 133 BC, he ran for and was successfully elected to the office of tribune. Now, supposedly, he was inspired by the sight of going down the road and seeing all these dispossessed Roman farmers and all these big estates being worked by foreign slaves. Taking advantage of the power of tribunes to propose new laws, Tiberius Gracchus put forward a new piece of legislation directly to the vote of the people, without first running it past the Roman Senate. At the heart of this proposal was a suggestion or a law that would limit the amount of land that could be owned by any one person. There was also a provision for distributing excess government-owned land to poor Roman citizens. In response to this proposal, at an assembly, a number of senators and their followers became enraged, and they literally broke up the benches that they were sitting on to make clubs. And with those, they beat to death Tiberius and 300 of his followers. This was a shocking event, but it was a vision of other things to come, because in the late Republic, Roman politicians would begin to substitute open violence for political debate. And so this kind of political violence will become typical over the next couple decades. That wasn't the end of this attempt at reform, though, because in 123 BC, the younger brother, Gaius Gracchus, decided to take up where his elder brother, Tiberius, had left off. So Gaius now runs for and was elected tribune, and he promptly put forward the very same proposals that Tiberius had. Now, Gaius looked around at the problems of the Republic, and he was very much aware that there were other unhappy groups in Roman society. So he now tacked on a whole slate of additional proposals. So he proposed that the Roman state give subsidized grain to all the inhabitants of the city, and that's something that would help the urban poor. He also proposed that the Latin allies in Italy finally be granted full citizenship. And he proposed building more roads, which would help out rural farmers with communication. Once again, though, the Senate was very upset by all these actions. But when they had beaten to death Tiberius, they had gotten what today we might refer to as a bad press. So, this time around, they themselves did not kill Gaius Gracchus. Instead, they simply let it be known that if somebody else just happened to kill Gaius, then they would give that person the weight of Gaius' head in gold. And soon enough, an enterprising man murdered the younger Gracchus, chopped off his head, and in order to maximize his profit, he drained out Gaius's brain and filled the cavity with lead. And supposedly this little bit of creativity earned him 17 pounds of gold. And it's interesting to speculate whether or not the tragedies of the next 100 years might have been avoided if the Gracchi's proposals had been accepted. But the Roman ruling class was resistant to change and would not concede anything. One of the unanswerable questions concerning the Gracchi brothers is, what really was their motivation? I mean, were these two guys, even though they were from the aristocracy, were they really altruistic? Were they really idealistic reformers who were just trying to do what they thought was best for the health of their country? Or were they perhaps self-interested, ambitious aristocrats who had merely come up with some clever new ways to gain power by pretending to be the friends of the common people? It's also interesting to wonder about what might have happened if the Romans had passed all of Gaius's legislation. Would doing that have extended the life of the Roman Republic? And there's really no way to know the answer to any of these questions, but what is now certain was that the Republic was headed for disaster. The first of the various resentful groups in Roman society to finally get fed up and explode was the Italian allies. For hundreds of years, they fought in Rome's wars. They even stayed loyal when Hannibal invaded. And so now they felt, with really a lot of justification, that they had earned the right to be granted full Roman citizenship. The Romans, though, refused to give it to them. And so finally, in 91 BC, a confederation of Italian allies revolt against Rome. The resulting conflict was called the Social War. That's because it comes from the Latin word socii, meaning the allies. The Social War was a particularly brutal and bitter war. Both sides are fighting with the same tactics, both use the same strategy, and really what it is it's a civil war. And it lasts for three long, destructive, terrible years. But ultimately, Rome was able to pound its allies into submission. But in the terms of the peace treaty, which ended the social war, the Romans were compelled to give full citizenship to all the Italian allies. So the social war is really a tragic example of Roman conservatism, of their resistance to change. Because even though the Romans won the war, in the end, they simply had to give the Allies what they wanted in the first place. So it was completely unnecessary. It was a waste. And it was a war that really should have been avoided. The same era also saw a number of huge slave revolts. So the slaves get fed up too. And the most famous of these slave revolts was led by a Thracian gladiator named Spartacus. And all of those slave revolts are also eventually suppressed, but not without a lot of bloodshed and cruelty. And again, the most obvious example is Spartacus and 6,000 of his followers ended up being crucified all along the Appian Way. The Roman Republic is really now tottering along under all of these strains. And the next half century, the last half century of the Republic, it is a complex time loaded with all sorts of dramatic events, political machinations, and a lot of famous people. And I think the best way to tell the story this time is to focus on the biographies of just two pivotal figures who lived throughout those decades. And in telling their stories, I'll also tell most of the history of the era. The older of these two guys is a man named Pompey. Pompey was the son of a famous and wealthy general, and really the key to understanding Pompey is that he was extremely ambitious. So, when the social war and some subsequent infighting among various Roman factions broke out, Pompey was too young to hold any elected office. But he just couldn't stand the thought that he was missing out on a golden opportunity to gain dignitas. So he used his family's money to raise a private army of three legions, mostly recruited from his father's veterans. And at the head of this personal force, he marches off to join the fighting. Pompey, it turned out, had some military talent. And in the resulting wars, he proved so bloodthirsty that he earned an interesting nickname. And that nickname was Carnifex Adulescens, which literally means the young butcher. After some additional military adventures, he comes back to Rome, and he wanted to celebrate a triumph. A triumph was a big parade awarded as a rare honor to exceptional victorious Roman generals. And remember, at this point, Pompey is still only in his 20s. But he's someone in his 20s with a private army, so he got his way. And Pompey wants his triumph to be bigger and better than anyone else's. So initially, he planned to ride into Rome in a chariot which was drawn by 4 elephants. Unfortunately, he encountered a practical problem when those 4 elephants proved to be too big to fit inside the city gates. And this little incident, I think, perfectly symbolizes the fact that just as Pompey's elephants were too big to fit through the gates of Rome, so too Pompey's ambitions are going to prove to be too big to fit within the republican framework of Rome's constitution. Pompey then sort of schemed to get some additional military commands, and he wins some further victories. Eventually, he returned to Rome, and he celebrated another triumph. And at this point, he's still only 35 years old. But he has never yet been elected to a formal office in the Roman state. And so Pompey isn't even a member of the Roman Senate. Despite that, though, he now sort of lets it be known that he wants to be consul of Rome. Even though there was a minimum age requirement for that top position of consul that he's nowhere near. But again, who can tell Pompey no? So he gets his way. So Pompey has created an entire political career which circumvented the normal route to the consulship. But by this point, he's so powerful that you just can't ignore him. Now, one of the duties of the consul is to preside over meetings of the Senate. But since Pompey has never been a senator, he knows nothing about how to run meetings of the Senate. And so to remedy this, some of the senior senators actually quickly have to write up a little pamphlet called How to Run Meetings of the Senate and sort of give it to Pompey. Next on Pompey's agenda was another military command so that he could gain even more glory, even more dignitas. And one of the big problems at this time was piracy. Pirates infest almost the entire Mediterranean Sea. They're plundering Roman merchant ships seemingly at will. And so Pompey now manipulates affairs so that a tribune, who's really being bribed by Pompey, proposes a law which would give Pompey unprecedented military power to suppress the pirates. And with Pompey's backing, this law passes. So Pompey is given a huge sum of money, he's given a fleet of 500 ships and an army of 120,000 soldiers. And if that's not enough, he's given authority over all the waters and coasts of the Mediterranean Sea. And this whole thing went completely against standard procedure for these sort of appointments. Earlier, the Roman precedent had been to divide up the Roman military among many different commanders, so that no one person commands too many troops. But Pompey now basically gets it all. And in what really is a brilliant campaign, which only lasts 40 days, Pompey wipes out all the pirates. For his next amazing feat, Pompey again manipulates some legislative loopholes in order to be given an army. And under the specific terms of his appointment, he's given that army to command until a particularly troublesome eastern king named Mithridates was dead. So Pompey has the army until Mithridates is dead. Pompey marched out. He very quickly defeats Mithridates, but the king escaped, and Mithridates runs off into the wild somewhere in Central Asia. He just disappears. He's hiding out in a cave someplace. Now, Mithridates is no longer a threat, and his country has been captured and turned into a province. But instead of pursuing Mithridates, Pompey now takes advantage of the terms of his command, which was you have an army until Mithridates was dead. And Pompey now takes his army and invades and captures the entire eastern coastline of the Mediterranean. And if you think who else went conquering in the east, well, it was Alexander the Great. And Pompey here, his hero is Alexander. So now, like Alexander, Pompey is going on a rampage through the east. And he's exactly imitating Alexander, and he starts to head for Egypt, which is where Alexander went. But right before he gets there, he gets a piece of bad news. And the bad news is, way up to the north, somewhere in the mountains, Mithridates has finally keeled over and died of old age. And remember the terms of his appointment? You have the army till Mithridates is dead? Well, this now means that Pompey's command over that army is over. So he has to stop his conquests. By this point, though, Pompey's expedition has made both Rome and himself unbelievably rich. As a result of Pompey's little rampage through the east, the tax income of the Roman state triples. And Pompey's personal fortune and his dignitas are now incalculable. Since Alexander had founded cities that he named Alexandria, Pompey now founds at least 11 cities, which he calls, you can guess, Pompeiopolis. Pompey has gained more power, wealth, and influence than any Roman before him. But in doing this, he's repeatedly broken the rules. He's risen to power working outside the system, and he's really undermined those old republican institutions. And this sets precedents that you can't undo. But at this point, when he reaches the pinnacle of his power, and he might have just taken over Rome, he still had enough respect for tradition that he disbanded his army, he returned to Rome, and he just goes into a kind of semi-retirement, where he is controlling things, but he's exercising power behind the scenes. We'll now leave Pompey for a bit and turn to one of his younger contemporaries, a man named Gaius Julius Caesar. And Caesar's very first public act already hints that he is going to prove to be, if possible, even more ambitious than Pompey. As a young man, Caesar had to give a funeral oration at the burial of an aunt, but instead of just praising the old woman, Caesar gets up and takes this opportunity to remind the crowd that he claimed to be descended from a god. That's a fairly egotistical statement for a young man who hasn't done anything yet. Now, unlike Pompey, Caesar's political career starts off fairly conventionally. He holds a number of elected offices, he holds them in the right order, he holds them at the right ages. But like Pompey, Caesar also has an Alexander complex. And one day, when he's serving in the army in Spain, he supposedly burst into tears. And when his aide said, "What's wrong?" he said that he had been thinking that at that same age, Alexander had already conquered the world. Caesar begins as a protege of Pompey, and with some help from the older man, he gets elected to the consulship in 59 BC. And the other consul for that year, remember there's always two, was a man named Bibulus. But Caesar totally dominates things, and he basically ignores whatever Bibulus wants. And eventually Bibulus feels so left out that he just retires to his house and leaves Caesar in charge of the Roman state. And this complete dominance of Caesar over Bibulus results in a popular joke at the time. Normally, legislation would be signed with the names of the two consuls for that year, but people said that in the year 59, bills were not signed with the usual words "in the consulship of Caesar and Bibulus," but instead were signed with the phrase "in the consulship of Julius and Caesar." Caesar then faces a bit of a crisis, because he knows that the moment he steps down from office, his enemies will prosecute him in the law courts for illegal actions. And because a Roman official cannot be prosecuted while in office, if he can immediately go to another office, he'll be safe, at least for a while. Caesar therefore arranges to be appointed governor of a little province called Cisalpine Gaul. And this was a small, pretty peaceful province with only a small army. But it was immediately south of Gaul. And Gaul was a huge, unconquered region, which is roughly equivalent to modern France, Belgium, and the Netherlands as well. And Gaul is inhabited by lots and lots of warlike tribes. Caesar sees this as opportunity. And immediately upon becoming governor, he starts to raise a private army, just like Pompey had done. And once an army is ready, he launches his own personal invasion of Gaul. And Caesar will ultimately spend 9 years fighting continuously in Gaul. He'll raise many more legions to support these campaigns. He'll build up a huge personal army of tough veteran soldiers who are totally loyal to him because that's who they get their rewards from, not the Roman state. Caesar, it also happens, or also turns out, to be a military genius in his own right. He shares the hardship of his men, and he has a very keen tactical sense. Now, Caesar's actions in Gaul, quite honestly, are just blatant imperialism. He would conquer one tribe, and then he would say, well, in order to make sure that this newly conquered territory is safe, I really have no choice but to just attack all the neighbors. And when those were beaten, it would just create more hostile neighbors, and so on. Caesar's 10 years of campaigning in Gaul kill or enslave millions of Gauls. And even the Romans thought Caesar's actions were a little bit questionable. At one point, a bill gets proposed in the Senate that Caesar should be turned over to the Gauls as a war criminal for his unwarranted aggression. But Caesar is always careful to have a tribune or two at Rome in his pay who can veto anything harmful that comes up against him. Finally, the Senate gets tired of it all, and they end Caesar's governorship. And they tell him, disband your armies, and you come back to Rome as a private citizen. Caesar knew as soon as he went back to Rome, his enemies will bring lawsuits against him. So Caesar now faces a choice. He could obey the Senate and maybe face the end of his career, or he could place himself above the state. And Caesar decides that his dignitas is more important than the Roman state. And so with the famous words, the die is cast, he crossed the Rubicon River. That was the boundary between his province and Italy. And he marched on Rome at the head of his army. And the moment when he crossed that river with troops, technically, in the Roman law, he became guilty of treason. This bold action seems to have caught the Senate completely by surprise. They seem to have expected him just to come home docilely. Faced with this crisis, the Senate was unprepared, they didn't have any troops, and so they now turn for help to the only man with the power to maybe oppose Caesar. And that, of course, is Pompey. And Pompey agreed to aid the Senate. And so you have a situation where the man, Pompey, who arguably had done the most to undermine the institutions of the Republic, now, somewhat strangely, finds himself cast in the role of the defender of the Republic against what really is a younger, more aggressive version of himself. What followed next was a colossal civil war fought between Caesar on one side and Pompey in the Senate on the other. And it lasts several years. It's fought all across the Mediterranean, from Spain to Greece. But Pompey, in the end, was overconfident, and he's eventually defeated at the Battle of Pharsalus. Pompey managed to escape from the battle, and he fled to the last remaining independent kingdom left on the shores of the Mediterranean that the Romans didn't yet control. And that was Egypt. Egypt was the last Hellenistic kingdom surviving from the breakup of Alexander's empire. And Egypt is still ruled by direct descendants of Alexander's general, Ptolemy. Unfortunately for Pompey, Egypt did not prove to be a safe refuge. Since fearing Caesar's wrath, the Egyptians murdered Pompey the minute he set foot on the beach. And when Caesar arrived right after that in hot pursuit, he was presented with Pompey's head by the Egyptians. And that was the rather ignoble end of Pompey the Great. One other noteworthy event occurred while Caesar was in Egypt. He met the young queen of the country, a woman named Cleopatra. And she was the last of the Ptolemaic dynasty of Macedonian rulers. and, as I'm sure you know, embarked on a famous love affair with Caesar. Caesar returned to Rome victorious in 45 BC, in control of the entire Mediterranean. He was now the sole ruler of Rome. The problems facing him were how to settle affairs, especially how to deal with all of his veterans who were looking to be rewarded. But secondly, and maybe more importantly, he had to find a way to rule Rome as one person. But because of that Roman's traditional hatred for kings, he somehow had to avoid appearing like a king. Caesar embarked on a very energetic program of reforms and activities. He settled 80,000 of his veterans in colonies. He granted full or half citizenship to many of them. He built all kinds of public works at Rome, and he even fixed the calendar. During all the civil wars, the calendar had gotten so messed up that it was actually 4 months out of alignment with the seasons. But Caesar fixed this all up, and he actually produced a new calendar. And that Julian calendar, with just a couple very minor adjustments made later by Pope Gregory XIII, is basically the same one that we use today. Caesar's biggest problem, though, was how to control things without looking like a king. And to begin with, he simply got himself elected consul over and over again. But after a couple of years of this, Roman aristocrats started to get resentful because Caesar was monopolizing one of the two available consulships. So then he turned to Roman tradition, where there had been a special governmental post called dictator, which occasionally the Romans would appoint in a time of extreme emergency. And the dictator had supreme power over the state, but he was strictly limited to a term of no more than 6 months. Well, in 44 BC, Caesar arranged to be given the dictatorship, but with a lifetime appointment. This really was an insult to the Republic, and it was tantamount to being a king. As such, this act provoked resentment. And it wasn't helped by the fact that Caesar just didn't behave very modestly. He did things like he had the Senate decree that everybody had to take an oath of allegiance to him personally. He renamed one of the months after himself, which is why we have the month of July still today. He had statues of himself put in temples, almost as if he were a god. He had priesthoods established in his honor. And he was rude to the Senate. He didn't even bother to pretend that they were his peers. All of these actions led to a general feeling that Caesar was acting like a king. And in Roman history, when you have trouble with a king, who do you turn to for help? Well, remember the oath of Brutus, the man who led the rebellion against the last Etruscan king, Tarquin the Proud? Well, as luck would have it, one of Julius Caesar's closest friends was a man named Brutus. And that Brutus was a direct descendant 500 years down the road of the Brutus who'd expelled Tarquin and sworn opposition to kings. So in the middle of the night, people started to write messages to Brutus on his house and in public places that said things like, "Remember your ancestor," or "You're not a real Brutus." Rome was a society in which family, the past, and tradition had enormous power. So Brutus, even though he's Caesar's friend, really has no choice. In 44 BC, a conspiracy forms around Brutus, and on March 15th, 44 BC, the Ides of March, Brutus and a group of senators stab Julius Caesar to death. In what I suppose you could say is a bit of poetic justice, Caesar fell dead directly beneath a statue of his old enemy, Pompey the Great. The compulsion that Brutus felt to emulate or to live up to the deeds of his ancestor, I think shows a real difference between our society and the Romans, and between their concept of the weight of tradition and ours. After telling this story in class, I always ask my students, how many of you would stick a knife into your best friend because of what your great-great-great-great-great-great-grandfather did? And not too many of them raised their hands. The Romans may have gotten rid of Caesar, but the Roman Republic was now trapped in a pattern of civil wars between pairs of strong men vying for supreme control. And over the next couple decades, these continuing internal wars will culminate in the death of the Roman Republic and the creation of the first Roman Emperor. Thank you.